difference of opinion on the spring.
I was on a short hike that ended up being a six-hour.
Good afternoon. It's active, exciting room here. We will open our subcommittee on public safety. Today is June 27, 2017, and we'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2131. I see Representative Barbara Smith Warner here to present this to us. But as you come up, if you can give us a quick overview, and then we will hear from Representative Smith Warner first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Before you today is House Bill 2131. It directs the State Fire Marshal to include in its existing plan for hazardous material response the location of oil or hazardous material spill or release response resources owned by railroads. Among other things, it requires rail carriers to demonstrate proof of financial responsibility to pay the cost of cleanup in a worst-case spill. The bill also directs the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt standards for the preparation of contingency plans for high-hazard train routes.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I'm thrilled to be here speaking to you about House Bill 2131. This is an issue that I have been working on since I came to the legislature in 2014. So I will go as thoroughly and as rapidly without missing anything as I can through this. I do like to give you a little context, because not only have I been working on this since 2014, but this is the second significant bill that we have done in this building on the issue of oil transport by rail. So over time, used to be hardly any oil was transported by rail, and then there was a great uptick in the 20-teens, whatever you want to call that, to the point where we are getting 24,000 carloads of oil a year through the state in 2014. It's gone back down. It was at about 10,000 in 2016, but even that is multiple times what it was just 10 years ago. And so safety while transporting oil by rail has been a growing concern since there have been a number of derailments, most significantly one in a Canadian town, which killed about 50 folks, destroyed the downtown area. And there was concern in Oregon about the increasing traffic with the discussion about a potential oil terminal in Vancouver, Washington. Now, Oregon is a pass-through state on oil trains. We do not have any refineries here, which is both good and bad. It's good if you don't want to have refineries in the state, but it's bad because it doesn't give you a point at which you can assess a fee on that in order to establish any sort of safety or other requirements. So in 2015, when I started working on this, my first bill on this was House Bill 3225. And I learned quickly how challenging it is to thread the needle between federal preemption, which railroad law has, and the needs and wants of the state on safety. So where we ended up going on 3225 is we were not able to successfully figure out a way through that in 2015. And so what we ended up with was a bill that really was very focused on the state fire marshal. 3225 gave the state fire marshal the authority to adopt a plan by rule for the coordinated response to oil or hazardous spills during rail transport. So basically, this gave them the ability to coordinate first responder plans and compile them, to require and organize trainings for local first responders and governments, identifying where equipment was all around the state, and establish this fund in order to do a lot of this stuff. It also established a rail coordinator position within the state fire marshal. And indeed, the first training that was run through that office happened just a few weeks before the unfortunate date that we all remember of June 3rd, 2016, when the Mosier derailment happened. So June 3rd, 2016, Union Pacific Railroad of 94 rail tank cars derailed in Mosier along the Columbia River. A total of 16 cars derailed, released 47,000 gallons, a fire, there was an evacuation. We learned a lot of important things from that incident. The first of which was we got regular feedback that because of the training that we had been able to coordinate from that 3225, that really helped in the response that happened to Mosier. And we learned also a lot about agency roles and responsibilities. Fire marshal's main objective in an event like that is to protect life life and safety immediately after a spill. It's what you typically picture when you think of a first responder. Fire Marshal also administers training and continues to build on that authority we gave them through House Bill 3225. So they do planning and training assistance and coordinate the statewide hazardous response teams. DEQ also has a role in these situations. Before anything happens, DEQ has a role in pre-planning response strategies to reduce any possible impact on public natural and cultural resources. During an incident, they work very closely with the state and local partners responding to spill, utilizing plans that are already there to ensure a quick and effective response. And then after, DEQ is the lead agency overseeing the cleanup. So DEQ is the state agency that is responsible for coordinating the cleanup of spills of oil and hazardous material. DEQ has an on-scene coordinator in this. And historically, DEQ works closely with maritime and petroleum industry to develop and implement strategies for preventing and responding to oil spills, because there is a federal law that was passed in 1990 after the Valdez spill that allowed DEQ to be the agency that got contingency plans for the shipment of oil by pipeline and by ship. So they have a role to play in these, and so in 2015 we gave the fire marshal some authority and resources, but we really did not address DEQ's role in oil spill planning or response. So after Mosher, we came back this session to try to deal with that. The first thing we did, honestly, was look to Washington State. So in Washington State in 2015, when we did 3225 that ended up getting focused on the fire marshal, they actually passed a bill, House Bill 1449, that required railroads to complete and submit contingency plans to their Department of Ecology, required railroads to demonstrate proof of financial responsibility. And here's the key. They were able to pay for all that with a tax on the oil that comes through their refineries. This is has been the challenging part for us, because, as I said, we're a pass-through state. We don't have the automatic way to do that. So what we did this year with 2131 is said, let's try to establish a consistent statewide approach. So let's do what Washington does in requiring these contingency plans. Let's do what California does in requiring these contingency plans. Let's loop the oil by rail into the contingency plans that the DEQ already receives and manages on pipelines and on oil by ship. So that's what you have before you, House Bill 2131. Basically, it adds railroads to other transporters of oil who already submit environmental contingency plans to the DEQ. It ensures that those railroad contingency plans are added to and coordinated with the fire marshal's compilation of local state. They work very closely together in this response. We continue to promote that cooperation. It expands geographic response plan mapping to include sensitive areas along high hazard train routes. Right now, we only have geographic response planning, which is as you go along, what are the environmentally sensitive areas where oil is being shipped now? Right now, we only have it where it's on water or along pipelines for things like breeding grounds, etc. We have that right now just along the Columbia River and up and down the coast. There are rail lines all through Central Oregon along the Deschutes where we do not have that. This bill also requires railroads to demonstrate their ability to cover the costs associated with a worst-case spill to make sure that local communities won't be left to pay the bill, expands the training and exercise authority that we gave to the fire marshal in 2015, and it indeed creates a dedicated high-hazard train route oil spill prevention fund for, specifically within DEQ, the oil-by-rail contingency planning and geographic response planning. It's a very specific fund with very strict sideboards about using it just for this. So ultimately, the engrossed version of this bill puts the responsibility of planning on the railroad. Given the local needs and the state authority that we have under the Oil Pollution Act, we have added owners and operators of high hazard train routes to that existing contingency planning statutes of the DEQ. There is an A-10 amendment that you have before you in Ways and Means. This was a combination of things, some Scribner's issues. There was an earlier draft where we took some changed language that defined it as class one and class, or that changed it to all trains, that we are back to class one and class two in this. Clarify some confidentiality language, and it makes consistent the references to the state fire marshal's office to say office of the state fire marshal. So, in conclusion, We really need a consistent West Coast approach to this work. Both Washington and California have led the way because they passed their bills in 2015. Railroads in Washington have submitted these plans, these contingency plans, to their Department of Ecology for review. And indeed, they used the same legislative hook that we did by adding rail to the existing Oil Protection Act statutes that we already have in this state. I really believe that we have to continue to plan and prepare for another oil spill. You know, Mosher was far from the worst case situation, and we're lucky that it wasn't. So 2131, what really makes significant progress in the midst of complex federal preemption issues. I got to tell you that you will hear. Nobody thinks this is a perfect bill because there are folks who want it, who want us to have stronger requirements about what the railroads have to do in order to do this. Well, there's a little thing called federal preemption and the Interstate Commerce Clause that we can't say, no, you can't do this if you don't. We put in the strongest language that we could with working closely with the railroads to get to something that they would be able to follow operating under the restrictions of we cannot say, you know, there were calls after Mosher. Let's shut down oil trains in the state. We can't do that. It is federally preempted for us to do this. So I'm just going to start there.
I have a question.
Please.
And my question is, it's about the contingency fund. What happens if it's never used?
That's a great question, Senator.
That's why I'm on budget.
Amen. I think I would ask LFO. You mean if the plans were never submitted?
Well,
never review. I mean, no, I'm just trying to figure out the reason the money wouldn't be
the legislation set. Requires a contingency fund in case there is what happened at Mosher and what have you. So I'm just asking if there should never be an incident, something never happens,
yes,
and those contingency funds are never used, what happens to those funds?
Sure. What it is actually is what this bill does is it establishes the fund in DEQ, a place for the money to go in DEQ specifically to deal with these oil by rail contingency plans. It is not a contingency fund so much as it is a fund. It is a place for that money to go because the railroads, rightfully so, there's a lot of federal issues about what their money can be spent on. And it can't just go randomly to DEQ to, you know, subsidize other work that DEQ does. It has to go specifically to do the work of these contingency plans into that fund.
So while we're on DEQ, Mr. Co-Chair, and I noted on Dash 11 amendments, mm-hmm, that there is a provision to provide for two limited natural resources specialist position, and I thought I heard you say that DEQ does have a coordinator or somebody who actually works in this arena and area. So my question is, why do you need additional positions?
Sure.
I'm not that much of a fan of adding positions to an agency.
I think I have heard that. So primarily, the idea is that what we would be doing with this is the railroads would be submitting these contingency plans to the DEQ, that we'd have to go through a rulemaking process to establish it, get the plans in. That's why they're limited duration, is because the idea is that you don't need this forever, but you are going to need
the capacity. So the existing person could not handle that.
Well, need. I cannot, DEQ may be able to answer, and I would argue that it would probably be an issue of capacity as well as expertise in oil by rail versus oil by pipeline or oil by boat. But I would be happy to throw that one. I know there are folks from DEQ who are here specifically to answer agency questions.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm extremely disappointed because you just said it wasn't a perfect bill, and I knew you were going to bring us a perfect bill. So I don't know what happened. Must be something in this building. I am generally supportive.
The art of the possible, as they say.
I do have a few questions for you. The fiscal part, I think I read, I don't know if it's Dash 11 or where, $600,000. Right, $600,000. So where is that coming from? Sure. And what monies were those? How did they get there?
Right. So there is a fund that ODOT administers that is, and I'm going to get the language wrong, so I'm going to warn you of that beforehand, that is a gross receipts fee that is assessed on the railroads that then goes to this ODOT fund that its purpose is to indeed do railroad-related things. And so we have had discussions over the course of this. In the long term, we continue to hope that the feds, just like they did with the Oil Protection Act, are going that allowed for the earlier planning, that they are going to come up with, because they've been threatening this for 3 years now, to come up with federal requirements about oil by rail regulations. And we hope that, you know, I have been hearing this for about 2 or 3 years now. We hope that those federal regulations will come with funds. In the meantime, in the short term, in order to get these contingency plans established and put in, ODOT is transferring $600,000 from that rail fund to this specific fund in DEQ to do the contingency planning. There is also, I believe, in the A-11s, an appropriation for the fire marshal's office as well to cover there, because one of the other things they want to do is a live statewide exercise on this, because as they kind of continue to work through. So that is where those monies are coming from and where they are going to. Honestly, the goal is to give our, to for the next 2 years, get the rules established, get the contingency plans in and reviewed, and both look at how do we shift to a longer term funding strategy if we need one, and potentially if the feds end up giving us this authority from the federal level to do this, and then potentially with either other ways they tell us that we can assess fees to do that, or that they provide the funding. I think it would probably be more likely A, that they would give us ways we can do it, rather than providing the funding themselves.
Follow-up. Mr. Chair. So this is a one-time investment from this fund that rail has paid into this ODOT rail account.
Yes.
And there's no intention of going after future monies from that at this point.
Not today.
Oh.
If I may be, well, oh, sorry. Without exclamation. Yes, that is the plan. That is the plan for this 2 year cycle, is to use that money now and to continue in the next 2 years to figure out where we could go to fund this in the long term if we continue to have that need. In my earlier draft of the bill, I had an assessment proposal to assess a fee by track mile on the railroads. And there was some discomfort with this. This idea came up as a potential one-time source of funding. And I would argue, I think it's worth taking and giving us more time to either figure out, is there a way we can do that track mile? Will the feds give us the authority to assess in some other way in the future? I think it's important enough. There is a little discomfort, and I will happily admit that there is some discomfort among the railroads in using this. And so, and at the same time, it's critical that we get these plans in. That was the biggest response we got when we were at Mosier, is literally people walking up to us and saying, you guys, Washington has this these contingency plans that you guys really need to have on your side as well. And I think it is critical enough to deal with this now, to use this imperfect funding mechanism for a very specific, we put as many sideboards as possible on the fund. We also put in the A-10 amendment here a statutory reference that connects DEQ with the fire marshal and ODOT on the hazardous material transport to make it as solid as possible.
Okay, and I think the noise you heard was the senator dropping the microphone.
Oh.
One more follow-up.
Well played,
and then
Senator.
We'll come back over.
Okay, so I'm going to have to put. I've only got one more follow-up, so I'm going to have to give you multiple questions in that single follow-up. I'm curious if we know if we're taking money from a fund that was dedicated for something else. What's going to go undone by taking those funds out of there? Because I'm interested in any account in a state agency that has $600,000 that's not purposefully direct. Okay. And for the ongoing part, my understanding, if I followed you, that it's to go for the rulemaking and the plan development and whatnot, although the rail has to develop the plan, but then the plan...
It's more the rulemaking. Oh, sorry. Finish your question because you said I don't want to miss any of your parts.
You said the rail companies would come up with the plan.
Yes.
The point I'm getting to is maybe there wouldn't be a need for funding beyond this in the future if it's largely for rural riding and the plans. Once we get those done, then it's an ongoing maintenance kind of a thing with oversight from the state office, state fire marshal, and DEQ.
That is indeed potentially it. I do want to throw in, though, the idea that we also want to give ourselves the opportunity to do the geographic response planning along those other rail lines where this oil by rail is being carried. Specifically, I mean, we always kind of call out the center of the state along the Deschutes River, where right now we don't have any of that. And that is the other element of this it's establishing things that do not now exist, but that aren't necessary. And I'm not trying to underplay this. We need to do the rulemaking. Then indeed, the railroads will put in the plans. We make sure they have everything in them that we need. We're doing the geographic response planning, and then the hope/goal is that you have that established. Forward. Now, you may have to update your geographic response planning every X years. I'm not entirely sure how they do it along the Columbia right now. You might be more familiar with that. And yes, that is the idea. Is let's get this in and established now. And going back to your earlier question, or the part one of your final follow up, the what is going unpaid? Part of where we got this idea about this rail fund is that the way that ODOT works with the railroads on this is they have a limitation of a percentage. It's 0.035 of their gross receipts, and they file that, and the railroads pay it, and then they give back what they don't use, because they have had years where they have had to go over, and they kind of negotiate and figure out, and they have years where they haven't gone all the way there. And the understanding with this is money that given how they have had to use the money and been able to give some back in the last couple biennia, that they are confident will not undermine what they are doing and allow this important work that has a key tie-in with the ODOT rail responsibilities.
Okay, so I'm not saying it's wrong, but basically it's the rail money paying for this process.
There. It is.
And I do want to get on the record.
It's a fund shift. It is the legislature's ability to do that.
We'll come back to it.
I want to thank UP and the fire chief and Mosier and DEQ and everybody that responded to Mosier. That could have been much worse, and I appreciate that. You kept saying oil, but this is hazardous materials, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Coacher Winters.
I just gasped because this is far more complicated than what originally was there. And I, when things are this complicated, I like to try to make certain that they're really sideboards, that we're not getting into somewhere to set up in the future. And that's why I asked the question about those positions. On the one hand, it appeared as though DEQ, some of their responsibility, that's part of their responsibility now and their coordination. And my question was just to do rulemaking, that you're going to need a 1.75 positions to do that, or whether one person could do that. That was my one fiscal question. The other one is to assure that the funds that are being transferred is not an ongoing process. So that truly on the record, it is one time and one time only. I think, when we start taking, we've had the same conversation when we look at things like the Fairview Trust, for example, which is dedicated for a specific purpose. And, all of us cringe when we start thinking about that we're going to raid something that started for one purpose in order to satisfy something over here that we actually don't really work for. My third one, and I'm have an awful lot of confidence and glad of what the agencies that came together, you know, and helped with the incident with Mosier. But I still have some, and I maybe it's because some of the other work that's been done by DEQ, you know, some of us have some real apprehension when we hear the word DEQ. I just have to be honest, you know, about it. They've, from our position, they've got given some no vote of confidences lately. And, you know, I want to be sure that, you know, they too will not see this as another grab. And I'm being very honest on the record. But, you know, I think that having to be able to make certain that we're compatible with Washington is okay. I just want to make certain there's sideboards that are there.
And California, too.
Yep. Are there other questions for the representative?
Thank you. And I would also just like to specifically call out, I've worked extensively with UP and BNSF on this, Representative Mark Johnson, and I know we check in with Representative Huffman periodically, President Courtney, who had a very similar bill, that I'm honored that this is the one that ended up moving forward. And the speaker has been, the speaker Kotek has been involved in this as well. So I just want to help everybody, as well as DEQ and the fire marshal, who have been super helpful and, you know, willing as we kind of work our way through this. It really has been a long educational process. And thank you all. And I need to leave, go back to two different meetings that I'm currently in. My staff will be here and will text me if any questions come up that that I need to answer. I'm happy to do that. So thank you all. And I urge your aye vote.
The time of year, and we all wish we could clone ourselves.
Yes.
Right?
We have a full page of signups. And so given that this has had other hearings, brevity is appreciated. Comments specific to the amendments that we're looking at are appreciated, and the fiscal issues around this are most appreciated. So, and a few people didn't mark whether they were for or against, so this is somewhat of a random order. I'll try to bring you up in pairs that I think are on the same side, but we'll start with Michael Lang and Regina Morit.
Good afternoon, co-chairs. I have some written testimony and an exhibit to submit as well. May I approach and hand that to you? Thank you.
Excellent. That's if you'll take it to the committee assistant to your left.
Yes. Shall I, or would you
please
like to? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs. For the record, my name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony. I want to start off by thanking the sponsors of the bill for the hard work that they put in this session and the education that everyone is receiving on federal railroad law, the authority of the states, preemption, what is preempted and what isn't. Friends, and you've heard about the background, and you certainly are aware of what happened in Mosier. I want to hold up and draw your attention to this table. This shows Oregon in comparison with our neighbors to the south and north related to rail safety law and also oil terminals. And the top four have to do with rail safety. If this bill passes in its current form, we'll still have the weakest laws on the West Coast related to oil trains. That will not change. And Friends supports meaningful, common sense legislation that will improve the state's emergency responses, make our community safer, protect our rivers and places like the Columbia River Gorge. Unfortunately, despite the hard work of the sponsors, this bill falls far short. Perfect is not even in the context of this discussion. There are some key things that are missing that were in the original bill and are in the Dash 2 amendments that our organization is supporting that are missing and have been taken out of the A. and Gross version. And on page 2, I believe, of my testimony, it lists those. I'll just cover them quickly. This eliminates essential standards for oil spill responses. Secondly, the bill's contingency plans are developed in secret. There's no public process. I'll tell you what, in Washington State, a Republican Senate bill passed that has broad public participation. They want the communities involved. They want to hear from people. They send out drafts, and the contingency plans are publicly accessible. This bill would essentially develop these plans in secret, bar access to this through Oregon's public records law, make these contingency plans and the supporting materials exempt from subpoenas, exempt from court orders. It has a secret process that is quite opaque and is not accessible to the public like communities of like the community of Mosier. The contingency plans are also not subject to approval, and they're not enforceable. And I'll turn your attention, please, to page 8, section 9, sub 4. And I'll just read, a contingency plan for a high-hazard train route is not subject to approval by the department. I'll move ahead in the same subsection, that if the plan does not meet the standards adopted by rule under subsection 2 of this section, the department shall, by conference, conciliation, and persuasion, endeavor to receive from the owner or operator of the high-hazard train route an updated or modified contingency plan. You know, I'm still learning. I'm not that young anymore, but that's a first. I've never seen that in a proposed bill or in a statute. So lastly, the elimination of fees. The sponsor testified to how Oregon is limited and preempted from assessing fees. Your own legislative council looked at this and issued a memorandum where it said, yes, the state has the authority to assess fees to the railroad as long as they're fair. And it cites the federal law that gives limited authority to the states to assess fees to the railroad. I think we all support fair fees. That's certainly within the jurisdiction and authority of the state of Oregon to assess fees in the railroad rather than passing the costs on to the general fund, the taxpayers, to subsidize contingency plans for the railroads hauling dangerous fuels through our state. So I know I'm probably out of time and I'll close, but we don't want Oregon to continue to be the weak spot. We can do better than this. And we do really support the original bill in the Dash 2 amendments. And we quote, by conference, conciliation, and persuasion, endeavor that this committee adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. Thank you for your time today. My name is Regna Merritt. I work with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I'm here representing over 2,000 health professionals and public health advocates, including Dr. Maria McCormick, who we work with in Mosier. She is a family physician and has practiced medicine in Hood River for the last 15 years, and her words are my words today. My husband and I own a farm in Mosier. My children attended Mosier School, and my younger son was an eighth grader on June 3rd, 2016, when that train carrying Bakken crude oil derailed and caught fire 600 feet from the playground with the school in session. In retrospect, I realized that derailment was a predictable catastrophe. Mosier and Oregon were lucky that day. Unfortunately, as oil continues to travel by rail, we can count on the fact that there will be more accidents and perhaps far worse events similar to the Lac Mégantic oil derailment that killed 47, displaced 2,000 people from their homes, and destroyed much of the downtown core of the community. Besides the obvious potential for loss of life from oil train accident, the health hazards of exposure to crude during the spill and during cleanup efforts afterwards include cancer, lung disease, loss of cognitive function, and endocrine disruption. The dispersant chemicals used are also highly toxic and are associated, again, with increased risk of cancer, lung, and endocrine diseases. Oil spills contaminating water reduce the viability of our local healthy food choices and can lead to digestive and reproductive health risks. In Mosier's specific case, the oil spill contaminated the wastewater treatment plant, rendering the town's sewage system inoperable, with residents unable to flush toilets after the derailment until cleanup efforts kicked into gear. That cleanup took months. Now imagine an oil train derailment in which lives are lost and catastrophic environmental and property damage occurs. How can we be sure there is an adequate response and enough money set aside to cover the cost of a multi-million or a billion-dollar cleanup effort? In my work as a primary care physician, I know that prevention is the best route to good health, but I'm also very mindful of the fact that accidents and predictable catastrophes occur. We need meaningful oil train emergency response legislation before the next derailment into or along the Deschutes, the Columbia, or the Klamath. Please make the Dash 2 amendments. Require tribal and public notification of contingency plans. Require the railroads to demonstrate the ability to meet the requirements of the oil spill contingency plans. DEQ civil penalty authorities against the railroads for failure to comply with the requirements of the contingency plans and financial responsibility statements. Restore the railroad safety fee assessments. The Dash 2 amendments are available to you, and I just implore you to please improve this bill and pass it with the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you for your service to our great state and our citizens.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we will have Paul, oh goodness, Hovernick, and Arthur Towers. We'll hear it in just a moment when you introduce yourself. We'll hear it again. Whichever order you gentlemen like.
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we really appreciate the chance to come visit with you today about this important legislation. We wanted to draw your attention to one key piece of the A10 amendments that we think is troubling, the section that has to do with the confidentiality of the contingency plans. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Bovarnik, who's spent decades in this field, and let him walk through the details.
Okay, thank you. My name is Paul Bovarnik. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I represent primarily victims of corporate negligence and misconduct. A large part of my practice for the last 37 years has involved the victims of railroad misconduct and negligence. I practice not only in Oregon, but Washington, Idaho, Montana, Utah, Colorado, and a couple of times Wyoming. So I'm very familiar with the operations of railroads. I have grave concerns about the lack of transparency built into this bill. As you know, the bill strictly limits the agencies and individuals who are able to have access to the plans of the state and the railroads. This is very problematic because if I am a business owner, say a car dealership, or I have a farm, or I have a school or an apartment building alongside the track where a release of dangerous chemicals might occur, I have no way of knowing what the state's plans are or the railroad's plans, and they have no way of knowing the best way, for example, to deal with a disaster on my property because they can't talk to me about it. They cannot tell me what the plan is. So, for example, if I'm a car dealer, I can't tell the state what is the best way to get to the track because I don't know what the plan is, and I can't be consulted, and the state isn't going to know. If I have a farm, I can't tell them where is my own hazardous materials, where is the fresh water, because I'm not able to participate in the creation of this plan. I think that makes for a much worse outcome for the planning and for the state in the event of a disaster. That's number one. Number two, the secrecy built into this plan is going to make it very difficult for any entity or individual to have a remedy. So, for example, if I'm Clatsop County and the Union Pacific Railroad puts an oil train into the river, upriver from me, I'm going to have a hell of a time because my fishery is going to be poisoned because my docks are going to be coated with oil. But I can't have access to the plan before or after it. And when my economy is damaged in Clatsop County, I have really no legitimate ability to sue them because I can't prove that the plan wasn't followed, much less what was in the plan. Moreover, if I do sue the Union Pacific Railroad, if I, as Clatsop County, do it, and this is true for everyone else, the Union Pacific Railroad can say, hey, we followed the plan. The state said it was okay. The fire marshal said it was okay. DEQ said it was okay, but we can't tell you what exactly it was they approved. One of the results of that is that if there is a disaster, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the hazards you may not know about in one moment. If there is a disaster and that plan is secret, either the plan's design was poor because it was secret, or its execution was poor, but you're never going to know it because it was secret, who ends up bearing those costs? It's the state, it's the individuals, it's the citizens of those jurisdictions where this disaster occurs, and it will occur. For example, had this bill been in effect in Mosier, whatever the Union Pacific Railroad did by way of inspecting the track and responding could be buried in that plan, and Mosier would never know what it was that Union Pacific didn't do, and they would be left without a remedy. Because this legislation was not in effect, the people of Mosier who have been most affected by this disaster have a shot at a remedy. So let me just give you a couple of examples from my own practice. About six years ago, I had a client. He had a long freight train with four locomotives, and one of them began spewing ash, burning oil, and sparks, set fire to a piece of the gorge on the Washington side. He called his dispatcher and said, what is the plan? And what they told him was call 911. That was it. That was the plan. 911 said, we can't reach you. We have no way to get our equipment, so we want you to take this burning train and move it a half mile to a crossing so we can get to it, which he did. He was seriously injured in the process. Fortunately, the volunteer fire department included a railroad employee who knew how to shut off the burning engine and keep it from going out of control. So only a handful of acres of the gorge were burned. No oil went into the river. And nobody ever heard about it, except for my poor client, who was so seriously disabled. I'll give you another.
Hold on just a moment.
I'm going to help my co-chair out a bit, but I understand that there's a lot of individuals who want to testify.
The last thing I'll say is railroads carry a ton of hazardous material. I've had clients injured by ammonia, by chlorine. I had one client injured by arsine, which was so dangerous that the Germans wouldn't use it in their poison gas in World War I. This bill, because of its secrecy, is going to not only make a remedy for the public bodies, for the private corporations, and for the individual citizens very, very hard to get. It's going to make it very hard for the state and local governments to adequately plan for the inevitable disasters, and believe me, they're coming.
Okay. Kevin, hopefully they don't come.
I've got 37 years.
I happened to weather the Vanport flood 69-70 years ago. So, and with all of our planning, we couldn't avoid that crisis either. But hopefully it does not happen, because it could be very catastrophic.
Correct. And just to close, the anxiety, one of the pieces of anxiety we have about this is that when the accident happens, when the catastrophe happens, if it does happen, as the bill's written, the potential for the cost to go back onto the state is very, very high.
Thank you. And we will hope, pray, and plan. So appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll have a pair of Toms, Tom Barrows and Tom Wolf.
Mr. Chair, can you remind us what amendments were actually...
We're looking at the Dash 10 and the Dash 11.
And his testimony, because Mr. Lang was talking about a Dash 2, and
correct.
So I don't want to get confused.
If I may, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that Dash 2s violate federal law. So we're stuck, and we cannot do Dash 2s because they violate federal law. And we're stuck, even though they have provisions...
I just want to be clear on what we were listening.
The amendments that we are most greatly considering today are the Dash 10s and Dash 11s. So, all right, take your pick, guys.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Tom Barrows, representing BNSF Railway. Johan Hellman, vice president of government affairs, was not able to be here. He apologizes, but he sent me some brief testimony here I'd like to quickly read you, if I may. We'd like, and I'd like to add myself to this too. We'd like to thank the sponsors for continuing to work with us towards our mutual goal of increasing rail safety in Oregon. And Representative Smith Warner and her office have done spent a lot of time trying to come up with something that's workable here. However, we find the bill currently before you is unclear and may conflict with laws passed in other states and with federal laws and regulations. Specifically, we have concerns with the definition of a reasonable worst-case spill because it is unclear how the current definition would be used, although we've gotten assurances that it's for the financial assurances portion, and that's where our concern has been, so that may be removed now. We have similar concerns about the definitions used for oil and for terminal as applied to railroads. To be clear, it's not that we object to state oversight, but rather that the definitions in the bill do not match existing definitions used to ensure safety and therefore would be unworkable in practice. To that end, we'd be pleased to continue working with you all to help improve clarity within the bill, and in doing so, make this law, this bill will become more feasible, workable, and enforceable. However, right now, we're not sure that that's the case. Be happy to answer any questions.
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, here representing Trout Unlimited, the world's largest, or the nation's largest cold water conservation group. Just real briefly, because I know you have a lot of people behind me, Trout Unlimited supports this bill. We have supported it as the Dash 2 amendments, but I realize those don't work, so we're here to support the Dash 11 amendments. And being a pragmatic man who's been in this building for 25 years, it's not, Dash 11s are not perfect, but we think that it's a start and should be worked on. Thank you.
Thank you. That was impressively brief.
Yes, that was
impressive. All right, thank you. Next up, we have Aaron Hunt and Peter Cornelson. Whatever order you prefer.
Co-Chair Starr, Co-Chair Winters, and members of the committee, my name is Peter Cornelison, and I'm a Hood River City Council member. And like you, I'm a politician. I listen to testimony and make decisions. And so what came to me to talk to you about today that might make a difference is the concept of public safety. We're all elected to serve the public and to promote public safety. So I want to ask, does this bill do as much as it can to protect Oregon? Or is it instead going to be a non-binding gift to the railroads? Union Pacific bore and bears full responsibility for what happened in Mosier. We saw the clouds, the black clouds of smoke over Hood River. We saw the freeways completely tied up, both Interstate 84 and Highway 14 in Washington. We heard about the kids in Mosier that had to be evacuated to the Dells. And if it had been windy, the fire would have consumed the Eastern Gorge, much of Representative Huffman's district. So the question really is, how much protection is this bill going to give? Hood River County, the city of Hood River, and the city of Mosier have all asked for the most protection possible. And we saw that as the Dash 2 amendments. And maybe those aren't going to happen. And if not, we're disappointed. But we ask that you give us the best bill you possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Aaron Hunt. I'm Director of Public Affairs for Union Pacific Railroad. Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Clearly, the Mosier derailment was a tragic incident. It's one that we have owned the response for ever since the incident took place. And we continue to work to assure that we are fully responsive to the community's needs. And that includes a number of things that we've done to make sure that our track inspections are enhanced to assure that the wastewater treatment plant that was damaged in the derailment is completely restored. We have regular meetings with the city, DEQ, and our environmental consultant to continue to measure the groundwater and make sure that things are trending in the right direction in that regard. Rail has an exceptionally safe track record as it relates to the movement of hazardous materials, but we do recognize that incidents do occur, and we worked hand in hand with the Oregon State Legislature, as Representative Smith Warner discussed, to pass House Bill 3225 in 2015. In this session, we've worked closely with Speaker Kotek, Representative Smith Warner, Representative Huffman, Representative Johnson, in a bipartisan effort to continue enhancing safe rail movement of hazardous materials. The bill, as amended, has improved legally and operationally, and we appreciate the changes that have been made. We are concerned, however, that Section 19 is added to the bill with ORS 824 gross revenue funds in mind. And there's been some discussion of that so far in the hearing. I want to reiterate that DEQ use of those dollars falls outside the statutory purpose for the assessment. And the formula used to calculate ODOT's fee to defray the cost of regulatory duties. ORS 824.014 states in part, the fees, fines, penalties, and other monies collected from railroads shall be used only for the purpose of paying the expenses of the department in performing the duties imposed by law upon the department in respect to railroads. The duties described in ORS 824.014 are specified in ORS 824.020 and 824.310 and refer to rail safety and crossing safety programs. So though the funding is problematic for us, Union Pacific is now neutral on the bill, and we really feel confident that all the parties have come together and worked hard to enhance rail safety, and we appreciate that. Thank you so much. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right. Eric Stride and Daniel Saris. See how many of these names I can butcher in a day.
It's like a gift.
You go first. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Strid. I'm a retired CEO and a co-founder of a high-tech company in Beaverton, which I took public in 2004. We created over 500 family wage jobs and have had zero issues with environmental regulations. So I ask, why is $20 billion Union Pacific allowed to recklessly endanger the lives and health of millions of people and thousands of miles of ecosystems with its fragile strings of rolling bombs? 1 year ago, a toxic plume of unknown composition arose over Mosier and drifted toward my home in the gorge. Fortunately, we had no wind, so Mosier was spared. Gorge highways quickly backed up and impending the emergency response while denuding PDX of their only foam equipment. It must have been the shortest NTSB investigation ever. They walked the tracks and found dozens of broken bolts with rusted ends indicating that they'd been there laying there for months. UP could have avoided this derailment by spending a tiny portion of their $7 billion op income on simply looking at their tracks. It's another case of profits over people. Why do we think this situation is acceptable? Oil tankers must have double hulls with personnel trained in firefighting and equipped with onboard firefighting gear. The railroad equivalent will have double wall tank cars and rapid response resources on both ends of the train. Mosier was the best case oil train.
If you'll move back just a little bit from the mic. We'll hear you better that way.
Okay. Mosier was the best case oil train derailment in the gorge. Calm weather, easy site access, and the forests weren't dried out. Oil train fires must be quickly controlled to prevent more cars from rupturing or exploding. A derailment could easily spill directly into the Columbia, where rapid spill containment would be critical to avoid dam contamination. Thus, I feel this bill is far too weak and must adopt the strongest amendments possible. Thank you for protecting Oregonians and doing your job.
for your testimony. Go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Dan Sears. I'm the conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper. On behalf of our 13,000 members, we support this bill in strengthening of this bill. And we're very concerned that the current version of the bill doesn't offer the level of protection that Oregonians sought in the wake of the Mosier derailment and fire and spill. The effects of the spill are still being felt in Mosier. The DEQ's latest report, groundwater is still contaminated with the oil that was discharged. As you've heard from others, Oregon has the weakest laws regarding oil train emergency response and financial responsibility on the West Coast. We need to do more to protect Columbia River communities. We learned about the oil spill from tribal fishermen who saw the accident and called everyone they had numbers for and basically alerted us. Two of our staff were at the Mosier derailment very soon after the derailment and quickly left, realizing how dangerous the situation was, and urged others to do the same. It wasn't the worst case. What we know from looking at not just that spill, but a study of a proposed oil terminal in Vancouver, is that a worst-case spill could be $5 billion or more in damage. And that was the result of an expert report commissioned by the city of Vancouver, Washington, looking at the largest oil terminal proposed in North America. The Washington Attorney General looked at a potential oil spill into the Columbia River and concluded that the range of damages was in the tens of millions to over $1 billion just for the restoration costs that would come. And so looking at this bill, we encourage you to look again at the Dash 2 amendments, even though I know those aren't strictly in front of you today. We think that was a much stronger version of the bill. The Dash 11 and Dash 10 amendments do not solve the problems that were created by the Dash 5 amendments, which we think significantly weakened the bill. One issue I just would really hit on more strongly before I close is there's no need for the secrecy proposed in the current bill. In fact, it's counterproductive. Community involvement in response to emergencies is, you know, it strengthens the state's ability to deal with emergencies. It strengthens local responders' ability to deal with emergencies. And so the idea of keeping contingency plans and financial responsibility statements secret is really counterintuitive, and I think is it runs counter to what people would have expected in the wake of the Mosier derailment, which would be added transparency and holding the railroad's feet to the fire. With that, I just want to add that we think that legislative council concluded that railroad fee assessments were allowable under the law, and so we remain convinced that those fee assessments are the proper way to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have Rhett Lawrence next, and that's the last person on my list. If you are here and did not have a chance to sign up, please let Julie, our committee assistant, know if you would like to testify within the next minute or two.
So. Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to testify. I'm Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. I'll be brief since I've submitted written testimony into OLIS, and much of what I had intended to say has already been said by others. Similar to the statements of Dan Sears from Columbia Riverkeeper now, we too support this bill. We wish it were stronger. We believe that the Dash 2 amendments would have gone a long way toward getting us to where we needed to be on this issue. Don't believe that the current Dash 10, Dash 11 amendments get us there. Agree that we could and should be doing a lot more to prevent the kind of catastrophes and put in place the responses that we need in the event of another and worse spill, as we saw in Mosier. So,
hold on just a moment. Co-Chair Winters.
Because I keep hearing that Dash 2s would be preferable, I've asked for a reason why.
Found something here.
And because I understand that there was federal conflict, so that other than, you know, people hear testimony, and often the reason why we don't go for it with something is not on the record.
Sure.
So I'm trying to get clarification of that. So continue with your testimony while I research what the issue is.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, and you know, we would appreciate hearing what that rationale is as well, because we believe that they, you know, it was compliant with the law and would get us where we need to go. So with that, I'll close, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we had one addition, Karina Miller.
All right. Nick Patraimi, Naimuma, Ignashwaniksha, Karina Miller. I'm a tribal council member from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I just wanted to make a comment really fast. I know that tribal consultation was mentioned briefly, but I know when this Mosier event happened, it was hard for our tribe to get any information right off the bat from the investigation point of view. And I know that oftentimes when tribes are invited to the table, it is for specific things like natural resources and the things we have with Army Corps with First Foods. But I also want to remind you guys that there's a lot more tribal history and spirituality and things tied to these areas that we really need to be included in this process. And I know there's federal oversight, but at what point are we sovereign nations and are we respected as nations that have an equal role in these kinds of responses? I know the Yakima Nation has a hazard team who are qualified that were part of the responders as well. That wasn't mentioned, but that's something that they've had to fight for. And I would just like to urge you all to keep in mind that the tribes are being very left out of the entire process. And that moving forward with whatever amendments or however this bill goes, that protecting these lands and protecting these people goes so much far beyond economic for Native tribes. And I just hope that you include us in the process more than we have been. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have one more?
Yes.
All right. Come on up. Make sure you introduce yourself since I don't have you on the list.
Great. Hi, co-chairs. I am Steve McCoy, representing Friends of the Columbia Gorge. I'm a staff attorney with Friends. I want to direct your attention to this. It's an OLIS. It's dated April 17th, 2017, and it's a memo from LC that discusses the dash twos as well as the base bill. And what it does is it lays out the different arguments of why this potentially could be preempted and then knocks each of them away. I'm not sure how much more there is to add to that. It says that we believe that the expansion is likely permissible. We believe that such an argument against the bill would fail. Local spill response laws are not preempted by federal law. We do not believe that a provision of federal law that would, or sorry, the Oregon Constitution that would preempt it or that would strike it down would apply. Anyway, it goes on. So I just wanted to direct your attention to this.
Thank you for highlighting that. We actually were looking for that document and had even put in a call to LC to come down and communicate with us on that. So appreciate your testimony.
Sure, and I pulled it off of OLIS this morning, so I know
yep.
it is out there.
Yeah, and it's listed under Rep. Johnson and the LC opinion. And we are actually going to stand at ease for about a minute and a half, maybe. So. Okay, we will reconvene. And we opened a public hearing and a work session at the same time. We had a few additions at the last minute, last call if you have if you were eager to testify and did not have the opportunity. Okay, and on that note, before we go into our work, as our work session, any general comments that people want to make before we start taking a look at the amendments? We are looking at the dash 10 and 11, which we will introduce in just a moment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. I appreciate concerns raised by both sides in this issue. I have not had an opportunity to read this LC opinion in huge detail, but much of what's in the dash 2 LC seems to say, and I'm not a lawyer, but LC seems to say that it could be challenged, but they think it would be okay, just as the last witness testified. I understand there were some other issues with the dash 2 that were problematic that are not addressed in the LC opinion that are more policy issues, and so that may be a reason we cannot consider the dash 2s, but I would agree that this is a step in the right direction, but express concern that it doesn't go far enough and that it does not provide for the safety and regulation that Oregonians deserve given the transporting of these hazardous materials. I'll vote for this bill because it's a step in the right direction, but I very much hope that we can come back in the near future with revisions that address any concerns in the Dash 2s that really have to be addressed, and we can move this bill further along. So I just want to get that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Senator Frederick.
Well, actually, I think Representative Sanchez was
next. Oh, I missed you.
I'm so sorry, Representative
Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, because I've looked through so many of these different pieces, and of course the bill is massive in my brain, and I haven't been able to find anything that specifically relates to the issue of the transparency that people were mentioning, so I'm wondering where that is. And I had actually texted
it
Representative
Smith. It's a provision in the Dash 10
it's
amendment.
It's a provision in the Dash 10.
That it talks about this.
And so I sort of actually texted Representative Smith Warner to try to ask her the question, but it didn't go through, so the basement.
I think it's, if I remember, because I was reading this afternoon, I think it's on the third page of the Dash 10s, but
okay.
Might get you there faster. Now, Senator.
Thank you. Well, the transparency issue was one of the concerns that I had as well. But I have a concern that's really basic. My district is essentially the transportation hub for the state. I have railroads coming through constantly. I have both the Columbia and the Willamette River. I have the I-5 corridor and the 205 corridor, and I have the airport. So it's everything is coming through there, I'm really concerned about this. This is something that I've been hearing about and heard concerns about for decades, literally, in my district, before I became involved and running for office. So this is a concern, and I want to see if we can get something done, because I just put it this way. If the derailment that took place in Mosier had taken place on Columbia Boulevard at the I-5 intersection with Columbia Boulevard, it would have been, I mean, disaster doesn't even begin to describe it. So I want to start this. We need to get something done. Thank you.
Co-Chair Winters.
Co-Chair Stark. I'm going to move us along because we are a budget committee, and I think that what was given to us was the task of the Dash 10s and the Dash 11s. Unless we decide that we don't have the votes on this body to actually go forward, then I think that we need to begin to work on the bill. Thank you.
And Ms. Nemberka, can you give us a quick overview of the Dash 810 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. I think actually Representative Smith-Warner gave a fairly good overview of the Dash 10s. They restore some definitions that were omitted in a previous version of the bill, specifically the definition of applicable rail carriers. It also does restore some confidentiality language for information provided by the railroads to DEQ.
Co-Chair Stark, I move the adoption of the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2131.
Co-Chair Winters moves the adoption of the Dash 810 amendments to House Bill 2131. Is there any other conversation on that? Are there any objections to that motion? Seeing none, so moved. The amendment is adopted. And Ms. Nemberka, will you give us an overview of the Dash A11 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Committee members, the Dash A11 is actually the budget amendment. It includes an appropriation of $318,044 of general fund to the state police, specifically to the Office of the State Fire Marshal. And it increases other funds expenditure limitation by $600,000 to the Department of Environmental Quality. That will go for planning activities and fund two limited duration planning specialists in that agency. The revenue for that other funds is from a fee collected by ODOT on railroads that we heard some testimony about just now.
Co-Chair Stark, while I do have some concerns, I move the adoption of the Dash 11 amendments to House Bill 2131.
Co-Chair Winters moves the adoption of the Dash A11 amendment to House Bill 2131. Is there any more discussion on this? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do continue to be concerned about the way that we're using funds that I don't think are going to be properly used. Having said that, I know we need to do something with the bill because I believe the bill is important. I believe it's a good addition to what we did in 2015. And I'm going to support the Dash 11, but I really would like to get on the record, hope that future legislatures do not go down this path again on the funding mechanism point.
Any other conversation on the Dash 811 amendments?
Only that I share the concern that's being raised by Representative Huffman.
Any objection to the Dash 811 amendment? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Co-Chair Stark, I move House Bill 2131 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Winters moves House Bill 2131 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Any more discussion on this? All right, well, I will comment that I, too, share the same concern about the funding source and the sweeping of that. I am going to support this today. I'm still strongly considering what my vote will be after it moves on. I want to have a little bit more time personally to take a look at how those funds are being used, what it does and does not say. That portion of the bill was only brought to my attention kind of late in the game on this conversation, so I'm not committing to a vote later, but at this point I'm going to support the bill. So on that note, Clerk, if you will please go ahead and call the roll just to make sure.
Senator Frederick?
Yes.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye with my options.
Not one of those things.
Senator Barker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Cornell?
Aye.
Representative Sanchez?
Aye.
Yes. Well, that was simpler than expected. So moved. And let's see. We need a carrier for full.
For full, probably Smith Warner.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, she is on that. Yeah, Smith Warner, and she'll do House floor and Senate floor.
Sure.
All right. And Senator Frederick for Senate floor. We will close our public hearing and work session on House Bill 2131 and open a work session on House Bill 2600. If you will.
Yes, sir.
Please give us an overview of where we're at with 2600.
Chair Stark, members of the committee, House Bill 2600 transfers the cost of volunteer programs from the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, which is currently in the Oregon Housing and Community Service Department, to the Criminal Justice Commission. We have a recommended Dash 6 amendment that would transfer the program to the Department of Administrative Services instead of the Criminal Justice Commission. Additionally, the Dash 6 amendment provides the language necessary to complete the transfer of the budgetary amounts. The Oregon Housing and Community Services budget bill was House Bill 5012 that passed earlier this session. It included $2,501,299 of general fund for the CASA program, which has $270,047 and one full-time position dedicated to administering the program within that $2.5 million. Additionally, there is a budget of $2,231,252 of other funds limitation, and this is used to distribute special payments to local county CASA programs. The Dash 6 amendment reduces these amounts in the housing budget and increases them in the Dash budget.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2600.
Co-Chair Winters moves the Dash 6 amendments to the House Bill 2600. Is there any discussion? Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say I want to first put a thanks to Ms. Koba and the other folks at DAS. This is not the kind of thing that you guys normally deal with, but for reasons that I think we've discussed at length, this is the right thing to do for this biennium. And I want to thank you in advance for the work that you're going to put in to get this help program, this really, really important program. I want to be crystal clear. CASA is critical to the well-being of children in this state, and I support it wholeheartedly, and I'm glad that it will have the benefit of your team's expertise to get it right-sized, stabilized, ready to move forward. And I think we need to see this as a temporizing measure to, and then we'll see where we go next in 2 years. But I look forward to watching the progress of this program.
under your auspices, Ms. Koba, and your team. So thank you very much in advance.
Any other discussion on the amendments? Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. We do have a budget note on this, so let's go ahead and hear about that.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, the measure, as you mentioned, has a proposed budget note. I'll read that into the record. The budget note states, given the nature of the work currently performed by CASA and the nature of work routinely performed by the Department of Administrative Services, the transfer of the CASA program to DAS is intended to be transitional for the 2017-19 biennium. DAS shall work with Oregon Housing and Community Services, the Oregon CASA Network, and other stakeholders to develop a plan for long-term placement and stability of the local CASA programs. This plan may include, but shall not be limited to, a review of the program's accounting and budgeting procedures and a review of available options for the CASA program's permanent placement. DAS may consider execution of a contract to assist in this review, but is not required to expend additional funds other than funds transferred over and dedicated to the administration of the CASA program. DAS shall report back to the appropriate subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee during the 2017 September legislative days on the status of the transition work. The Legislative Fiscal Office would note that given the intention of this to be a transitional move and the need for DAS to have flexibility in conducting a review of the program, the current full-time position dedicated to this program is recommended to be adjusted from permanent to limited duration. So they have the flexibility to see if that's what they need to continue with or they need different types of resources.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we accept the budget note to House Bill 2600.
Co-Chair Winters moves the adoption of the budget note to House Bill 2600. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move House Bill 2600 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Winters moves House Bill 2600 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Well, I will say, you guys know I love CASAs. You made a big difference in my life personally and in the lives of my children. We'll keep, as this body, we'll keep continuing to make sure we make life function easier for you guys so you can do your job. So hopefully this is one of those steps.
Yeah, Representative Stark, I think while we're piling on CASA, there's only one thing I'd like for this body to think about. CASA is a great program, but we've been remiss in this body. In providing them the resources that they need. When one considers that I believe that CASA's, that our contribution to this volunteer organization has been minimal at best, and yet we ask a lot of them in working with the children, with our children. And I think that I hopefully with the work, and I know the good director very well, that with her work with them, that hopefully when they come back next session, that not only will they have found a home and not only will they have the finance, the structure that they need, but also with it will come the recommendation of where we can propel and move this organization forward. You know, I've been very concerned about when we don't have, quote, the exact spot for entities like CASA, that on the one hand, we require them to do the community work and to be nimble. And yet on the other hand, we want to put them inside a bureaucracy where they can't be nimble. So I just need to say that, you know, we've done the same thing with the relief nurseries. We require that they engage in our communities, that they go out and be community engagers and what have you, and yet, we want to try to make them into this box, and they can't be nimble as well as being controlled. So I need to put that on the record on behalf of CASAS. I know that they have struggled over these many years of, one, trying to find a home, and two, getting the support of this body. So thank you, Director Koba, and I know in your able hands that you will, next session when you come back, that we'll probably see a very good package.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the measure moves. And I would like to take it to full. We have chief sponsors, Rep. Olson for the House floor and Senator Cruz for the Senate floor. And anything else for the good of the order? All right. Well, on that note, we will close our work session, and we are adjourned. However, if you guys can stay put for just a moment, However, if you